We're nearing the end of the book of Shoftim, and we're about to read about the most morbid, the most decrepit time in Jewish history, the most hideous acts that you could imagine Jews would do, things that every time I learn them, I'm taken aback by the sheer grotesque nature of what goes on and how the Navi minces no words and tells us exactly what happened here. And so we are nearing the end of the period of the judges, and the end of the book of Shoftim takes us through a marvelous journey of sin. The people of the tribe of Dan, who will take an idol into their midst, the people of the tribe of Benjamin, who will attempt to rape a man who comes to their midst, and then will spend the night raping a woman to death, and then the people of Israel going and waging civil war against the tribe of Benjamin. That's what we're going to learn about tonight. And as we learn about it, I want to begin with a point to ponder. The Gemara tells us in the Talmud in Sanhedrin, says the verse says in Mishle, Rabot Banot Asuchayil, many girls did valorous things, were girls of valor, Va'atalit al Kulana, and you were above them all. The Gemara has different interpretations what generations King Solomon is talking about. And the final interpretation the Gemara offers, or I don't remember if it's the final one or one before the final one, the Gemara says, there were many great generations. That's a reference to the generation of Moshe. That's a reference to the generation of Yahushua. And you were above them all. That's the generation of the judges. And I humbly suggest that they're talking even about the generation we're going to learn about tonight. Because the focus of the generation we're going to learn about tonight is that there was no king in the people of Israel. The book of Judges leads us directly into the book of Samuel, which we will begin either tonight or next week, which is the book about our kings, our King Saul, and ultimately our King David. And the book of Judges leads us to the inescapable conclusion we needed a king. And that's why the book of Judges perhaps ends with these terrible tragedies. And yet, where do you find a people on the planet who could live without a central leadership and they abolish evil from their midst? They unite 500,000 people to fight against evil in their midst. Yes, there was a group of gangsters that surrounded a house on the hilltop of Benjamin and did hideous things. But yes, the people of Israel united and went to war. And even though they lost 40,000 people, they didn't stop from going to war because they said this cannot be in our midst. And so when the Navi describes this period as a period where there was no king in Israel, our first thought is, what lawlessness. Look at what happened because there was no king. But we have to have a second thought. We have to have an afterthought and realize what a great people we are. That when there was no king in our midst, yes, there was a problem. There was a hilltop. There was a group of gangsters who surrounded a house and did a terrible thing. But there was a people of Israel who would not let it happen, who would not let it just happen and become an occurrence in their lifetime. We live in a day where you turn on the radio and every day terrible things are happening. You can't turn on the radio when your kids are in the car. You can't, it's not right. They shouldn't be hearing such things. And we don't react.
But didn't they instigate the war against Benjamin by mutilating her corpse and stuff?
Let's see.
That's not so much like...
Okay, so let's see. Our story begins with a man named Michai who robs his mother. And it's unclear whether his mother was that infamous Delilah who brought down Samson, because he does steal from her 1,100 silver coins, and that was the amount that each governor of the Philistines gave Delilah. Or the Navi just juxtaposes these stories to show us what these two women did with their money. And he comes to his mother and says, I heard you cursing the guy who stole them. Well, I stole them from you, Ma. And she says, well, I don't want you to be cursed. You should be blessed for God. I am going to give you the money. I sanctified it for you. You have a temple in your house. I want to make a molten figurine for worship. And she takes 200 silver coins and she pays the wages of a smith. And he makes it into a molten figurine at a specific hour when it could connect with specific forces in the heavens. And he has it in his temple. And Micha is a missionary. Micha is very nice. You know what the missionaries do? They offer free food, they offer free education and tuition and hot lunches for the kids. So that's what Micha does. Micha welcomes guests, and Chazal say it was because of this trait that he was kind to other people, that God had compassion over him. And so he makes an ephod, he makes a special apron, and he makes trophim, special figurines, and he appoints his son as the priest. And the Navi points out, this is one of three times that the Navi points out, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what they saw as right, which on the surface indicates that was a problem. That's why a man like Micha could get away with having a temple in his backyard. And on a deeper level, as we mentioned earlier, it indicates, yes, there was one man, Micha, who did something wrong, but there was a whole people of Israel who did something right. And there was this lad, a Levite, from a Judean family, and he left Beis Lechem, not the Beis Lechem in Zebulun territory, but Beis Lechem in Judean territory, and he was looking for a place to live, and he comes by Micha's house, and when he tells Micha he's a Levite, he's a Levi, so Micha tells him, sit here, you be our teacher, you're a Levi, you're supposed to teach Torah, you be our priest, and I'll pay you for your time, I'll give you clothing, I'll give you sustenance, and he lives with him, and he becomes a teacher, he becomes a priest. Chazal tell us that this child was Moshe Rabbeinu's grandson. Moshe Rabbeinu had a grandson who had a tradition from his grandfather that a person should always work avodah zarah rather than rely on handouts. What Moshe Rabbeinu meant was avodah, work, which is zarah, which is strange to you. Even if you have to work a job that you're not familiar with, do it, but don't rely on handouts. The kid understood it to mean avodah zarah literally, so he didn't believe in this stuff. And when people would come and offer sacrifices, he'd always explain to them, come on, this is foolish, what do you need this for? You need a cure? Go pray to God, I'll eat your apples, but don't offer it to the idol, you go pray to God and you'll get better. He just loved money, so he took this job. But he wasn't really getting people to worship this idol, and that's why King David later took this kid named Yonasan, he took him as his treasurer, he helped him do tshuva. It didn't help, because years later the kid went back to his old ways and again took money for being a charlatan for idol worship. Now Micha says to himself, now I know God is happy with what I'm doing, because he sent me a lady to be my priest. Now the tribe of Dan, they didn't have enough room for their tribe, so they were looking for territory, and they sent five of their leaders to spy out the land and see where they could find some land, some territory that was near Israel, where they could expand their territory. And that's what they did ultimately. They went north of Israel and they took territory by the Banyas, by the where the Jordan begins. And they come by Micha's house and they recognize his voice, because they had been living in Judean territory for lack of a place to live. And they asked him, what you doing here? And he told them the whole story. And they said, okay, so ask the idol if we'll succeed. And he tells them, go in peace, Hashem should help you. Notice again, he's not too interested in this idol. And they go and they come to the city of Laish, which is way up in the north. And they see that the people of Laish, they have no one nearby, and they have no relatives who would come to their assistance, and they have no peace treaties with anyone, and they come back to their families and their friends, and they say, let's go north, we saw territory that's amazing, it's lush, and we got to be quiet so no other tribe grabs it first, and you'll see that this will be territory that's easy to conquer, and there's nothing missing there, you'll have anything you want. And they start traveling north, and they pass by Micha's house. And the five leaders, the five officers, tell the people, you know, over here, there's an idol. Why don't we take it? We'll have a temple up with us out there in Chutzlar. It's up in the north. And so they go to Micha's house and they greet the Levite. And the 600 people, all armed, come and stand by the gates. While he's schmoozing with the people at the gates, the five officers go in and they take all the idol and the ephod and the trophim and the masecha. They take all the different idols he had in there. And they take it out. And as they're leaving, the Levi Yonasan says to them, what you guys doing? So they said, quiet, why don't you come with us? You could be the leader. You could be our rabbi. Why should you be a rabbi in a small house over here, a small community? You could be the rabbi of a whole tribe in Israel. Come north with us. Isn't that a bigger merit? So he figures that's a nice idea. We see again, he's money hungry. No akar satov to Micha for all he did for him. And they travel north, and they put all the kids in the front. They figure Micha might try chasing after them. And the Levi goes in their midst. He doesn't want to see Micha. That would be pretty embarrassing, wouldn't it? So they're traveling. And Micha and his family and all the people in the community, they realize their temple's just been robbed. They all get together and they chase after the tribe of Dan. And when they reach out, they reach the tribe of Dan, the tribe of Dan asks them a very cynical question. What are you guys getting so excited over? So Micha says, what do you mean? You took my God, you took my priest, why did you leave me? What are you asking me? What am I getting all excited for? So they said, you know, you shouldn't talk so loud because there are some bitter people here ready for war and you could really get hurt. It would be very sad if you and your family and all these people would just die. It's not a good idea. And they turn around and they keep traveling.
The mafia.
Right, mafia, right. They speak gently but carry a big stick. And Micha sees that they're much stronger than he is. He's got no choice. What's he going to do? So he turns around and goes home. And they take it all north and they come to Laish. And they destroy Laish. It's not as easy as they expected. They have to actually burn the city in the process, which is a pity, because then they have to rebuild the city. And they destroy the city completely. And they rebuild the city, and they name it Dan. And they set up this idol. And they set up this kid, Yehonasan, to be their priest. And him and his children are priests for years to come, until the period of Shmuel. And the Navi again reminds us there was no king among Israel, and it goes on to the next story. So story number one, a whole tribe of Israel has established an idol and a priest in their midst, and the people of Israel are silent. So we have a problem. And there's no king, there's no central leadership, otherwise maybe there'd be a reaction. As we find, the second Shmuel comes onto the scene, Shmuel takes care of the problem. He removes it. And we're told the story of a Levi. The Levi takes a pilegish. Initially, she's called an Isha, and later on, she's called a Na'ara, which leads us to wonder, was she 12? Like a Na'ara usually is. And she's from Beis Lechem. Notice we keep revolving around Beis Lechem. And the Pasuk says, Vatizne olav pilagsho, which could mean she was unfaithful to him. She went with other men. It could also mean that she turned away from him. She left him and ran back home. They had a fight. He found a pebble in a soup. He yelled at her. She got all upset. She ran back home. And she was there for 4 months. And then he comes after her and to bring her home. And he comes to his father-in-law's house. And his father-in-law is very happy. And he greets him and he hugs him. And they spend 3 days together. His father-in-law obviously wants to see that things have settled down between them. They eat, they drink, they sleep, and on the fourth day they get up early to go. And the father-in-law says, have a good meal, and then you go. They sit down to eat, he gets ready to go. And the father-in-law says, come on, why don't you sleep another night? You'll feel better. And the guy says, no, I gotta go. And the father-in-law says, no. And he doesn't want to fight with his father-in-law, so fine, he stays. The fifth day again, he gets up bright and early, he's ready to go. The father-in-law says, nah, have a good meal. Why should you leave? It's gonna get hot. So he appeases his father-in-law, he sits and eats. He gets up to go, he's with the pilegish and the nar, and the father-in-law says, look, it's really late. You guys aren't going to make it back in nighttime, and you're going to have to rest somewhere. Why should you sleep in a strange town? Sleep here, you'll get up early, you'll get out on your way on time. And the guy says, forget it, I've had it. He leaves. And of course, he's not making it on time. He comes to the city of Jerusalem, which was not yet captured. It was still in the hands of the Yavusi. And he has the donkeys with him, the donkey for himself, for the pilegish, for the lad. And the lad says, why don't we rest in that city? And he says, no, I'm not going to a Gentile city. They're not Jewish. Let's go on to the hilltop of Benjamin. And the lad says, okay, but let's be quick. It's getting dark. They come to the hilltop and they're sitting in the center of the city. And no one offers them a place to sleep. Now they had everything they needed, and an old man comes, and this man was not from that town. So we see the people of the town were cruel. They were not like we'd expect Jews to behave. They were not like the descendants of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. They didn't see a stranger and say, gee, what do you need? Maybe we could give you a hand. No, the whole city was not interested in helping. Who was interested in helping? An old man who did not live in that city, who happened to have come from Har Ephraim. And the people on that hilltop were from the tribe of Benjamin. Now he sees the guest and he asks him, where are you going? Where are you coming from? And the guy explains to him, that he's just coming from down yonder and he's on his way back home to Beis Lechem, and he believes in God. He shouldn't worry that he's from Pesel Micha or anything, but no one's taking me home. And he says, you know, I got everything. I have all the food, I have wine, I have bread, I have everything for us to eat. I don't need anything but a roof over my head for the night. And the guy says, no, God forbid, come with me and I'll give you everything you need. Don't sleep in the street. He brings him home. Now, our first thought is to compare this with what we read in last week's parsha, Lot and the Sodomites. So the first point of difference is that in Sodom, this was the law. And here, in the tribe of Benjamin, this was not the law. In Sodom, it was forbidden to take in guests. And that's why Lot tells the angels, come quickly, quietly, before anyone notices, come into my house. Here, the old man takes him in, and he has no problem with it. The next point, they come into the house, they eat, they drink. And the pasuk clearly points out it was the wicked people in the city who surrounded the house. This wasn't the whole city. It wasn't the whole city of Sodom and Amorah. It was the wicked people in the city. And they're knocking on the door. And they're knocking. And they're knocking. And they tell the owner of the house, the elder, give out the man who came to you tonight. We want to know him. And you guys know what it means to know a person biblically. So the old man comes out and he says, brethren, don't do such an evil act. Was Lot ever able to tell the Sodomites, don't do such an evil act? What does Lot tell the Sodomites? Lot says, you know, he's my guest. It's not right when he's in my house that you should do this. But he never tells them, don't do such an evil act, because he knows he won't get away with that. This is the law in Sodom. So if this is the law, then we're just following orders. We're doing what's right. In Sodom, the pasuk points out, it was the youngsters to the elders who surrounded the house, because it wasn't an issue of desire, it was an issue, this was the law. The guy was transgressing the law. Here he was bringing in guests into his house. That's a terrible thing, we have to teach them. So the elders were there, just like the youngsters were there, and the pasuk explicitly points that out. Here the pasuk points out that it was all about desire. It was the wicked who were there. And
where does it say wicked?
B'nei Belial. Anshei b'nei v'lial, pasuk chaf beis. And he says, I'll give you my daughter, I'll give you his concubine, his pilegesh, you can afflict them, do them what's good in your eyes, but don't harm, don't do this disgraceful act to this man. And they're not willing to listen. And so this man, in panic, pushes out his concubine, and when they see what a good-looking girl she is, they spend the whole night doing this to her, and how come when the morning comes, they let her go? So I didn't see any commentary say this, but I thought to myself, maybe they knew if they'd be caught, if anyone would see them, if she would see them, if anyone else would see them, then they'd have to face up to the authorities. But it doesn't say that. I didn't see that in any of the commentaries, why they let her go in the morning. And she comes and she falls by the door.
Maybe that's just where she died.
No, it says clearly not. It says that she crawled, she made her way back to the door, and she was there till it became light, and he got up in the morning. I don't know what that means. Does that mean he was able to sleep that night? I don't know what that means. He got up in the morning. And he opens the door, and he goes out to go his way, and he sees the woman falling by the door, and her hand is on the doorstep. And he calls out there, and he says, get up, let's go. And there's no answer. And he lifts her on the donkey, and he goes back home. He comes home, he slices her into 12 portions, and he sends her body to each tribe other than Benjamin. And obviously anyone that sees a body so bruised, they say, what's going on here? Nothing like this ever happened in Jewish history. We have to do something. And the Jewish people all unite, from the very north of Dan, who was in Chutzarts, to the very south in Be'er Sheva, and over on the eastern side of the Jordan, all of Israel unite, and we have 400,000 people, almost 500,000 people, just soldiers, come together. And the tribe of Benjamin hears that the people of Israel have united, and they do nothing. And the people of Israel try to find out what's going on, and the man tells them. And the people of Israel had a tradition that all of the people of Israel equals a king. Meaning a king is allowed to react out of the context of the law. That's the king's job. The law of the Torah is good up to a point. At some point the Torah says, I can't deal with every detail. This is where the king has to interfere. The king's job is to use his logic and reasoning and kill or punish based on his understanding beyond what the Torah says. That's the job of the king, so to speak, to fill in the gaps in the Torah. He has to be a just king. He has to be a kind king. He has to go with the spirit of the Torah. But he also has to know that his job is, so to speak, to fill in the gaps. And now the Jewish people united have the halachic strength of a king. And together, when they hear the story, even though we don't have two witnesses, even though technically, halachically, if 100 people stab a person and we can't validate which one killed him, we can't kill any of them. So halachically, you couldn't do anything to these people. It's up to God to take retribution from them. God or a king? A king could say, I have to interfere, even though technically, halachically, the courts cannot intervene. We don't have witnesses. Who's to identify who did this? And even if you identify who did this, who killed her? So technically, the courts can't get involved here. This is beyond our realm. There's no witnesses. A terrible thing happened. Something has to happen. But the Jewish people say yes. But we, united, equal a king. And if we equal a king, then we have to respond. And have to respond means that we first demand from the tribe of Benjamin to give over those people or do justice with those people.
How could they be fully united if Benjamin isn't
okay. It's a good question. I guess they didn't need Benjamin. So the tribe of Benjamin refuses. Now the people of Israel say, okay, if they refuse, then they're siding with them, and that leads them to civil war. And so they decide they're going to take 10%, they're going to be responsible for bringing food, and the rest are going to war. And they, after begging the tribe of Benjamin, how could such an evil thing happen in your midst? Give over the people who are on that hilltop and we'll execute them and remove evil from our midst. The tribe of Benjamin refuses. And obviously there was also some halachic background here, a halachic dispute, but the tribe of Benjamin were obviously in the wrong. And so there's war. And we have 26,000 soldiers from Benjamin, and Benjamin isn't scared. Benjamin are exceptional warriors. They have 700 people who could shoot a slingshot from a distance and hit a hare. So they're very powerful warriors. And again, we see here the problem that there's no king to unite the people. And the people ask God, should we go fight war against the tribe of Benjamin? Who should lead us? They don't ask, should we fight? They ask, who should lead the war? God says, if that's your question, Judah should lead. He always leads you. They didn't ask if they should fight. They go to war, and they lose. 22,000 Jews fall. 22,000 Jews killed by the tribe of Benjamin. And they're weeping, and they ask Hashem, should we continue war with Benjamin, my brother? They realize they erred. They spoke about Benjamin as a stranger. They forgot to mention, hey, he's our brother. And Hashem says, okay, go ahead. And again, God didn't say they would win. They go the second day, and they lose 18,000 people. So they've lost a total of 40,000 Jewish men have been killed, and 1,000 from the tribe of Benjamin. And they weep, and they fast, and they bring sacrifices, and they ask Hashem, and this time Hashem says, go, tomorrow I'll give them in your hands. Why did they lose the first two battles? God said, you're fighting about your honor. Where are you with regard to my honor? How come one of your tribes can worship an idol and no one says a word? But if this happens, you all react. Wait a second, where were you when the tribe of Dan took an idol in their midst? You're going to war with the tribe of Dan with an idol, and I'm supposed to back you in this war? Why don't, if you're going to do a self-cleaning, why don't you look at a big sin, another big sin? So even though God told them they'd be successful, the rule is that even when God says we'll be successful, He expects us to do the maximum. So they set up an ambush, and they attack on the third day, and this time again they start running. So the tribe of Benjamin assumes they're winning the war again. So they're on the run, and the tribe of Benjamin follows them, and the ambush enters the city, and destroys the city, and burns the city. And the second they see the sign that there's a lot of smoke coming up from the city, they turn around against the tribe of Benjamin. The tribe of Benjamin turns back. They see their city's on fire. They realize they've been had, and they're caught in the middle. And until they realize they've been had, even though they're caught in the middle, they fight both sides valiantly. They're tremendous soldiers. The second they realize their families have been killed, their city's been taken, they try to run in another direction, and the people of Israel surround them and kill them. And the tribe of Benjamin is annihilated aside from 600 men. All the tribe of Benjamin, they go city after city, and they destroy them like an Iran Nidachas. Just like the Torah says, if you have a city that went after idol worship, the city has to be destroyed. The tribe of Benjamin that backed this hideous act, the whole tribe is destroyed. Men, women, children, finished. The tribe is destroyed. 26,000 people. 600 men are left. And the people of Israel took two vows. They took one vow, none of us are giving our kids to marry the tribe of Benjamin. Anyone that's left, we don't let our kids marry into that tribe. And the second vow they took was that if anyone did not join our war against the tribe of Benjamin, we're wiping out that town. And they found out that the town of Yavesh Gilad, seems they had an affinity for the tribe of Benjamin, because they did not partake in this war. And we will see that when our first king is appointed, he is from the tribe of Benjamin. He is from these 600 men that are left. His name is Saul, Shaul ben Kish. God is sending a clear message. Benjamin is one of Israel, and God chooses our first king from Benjamin. And his first war is to protect the people of Yavesh Gilad, the people who did not come to annihilate the tribe of Benjamin. But the people of Israel hear that the people of Yavesh Gilad did not join the war. They send their soldiers and they annihilate the area of Yavesh Gilad, killing everyone aside from the women who had never been wed. And they have 400 women for the 600 men. So they send word to the 600 men. They regret a whole tribe is going to be annihilated from Israel. They weep and they regret their vows. But what can they do? They send the 400 women out. They said, we won't give our own daughters, but these aren't our daughters. But there are still 200 men from the tribe of Benjamin who don't have wives. So they can't figure out what to do. The elders tell the tribe of Benjamin, here's what you do. There's a holiday in Shiloh, and you guys go to the vineyards, and when the girls go out dancing there, so then you'll each grab your wife and you'll go back home. And when their fathers come and tell us, well, what's happening? Let's go to war. They took our girls. We'll tell them, what can we do? Is the tribe going to be annihilated? We promised we wouldn't give them our daughters, but they took them. You didn't give them. The Talmud tells us, the Medrash tells us a story that Saul was embarrassed to go and pluck a girl. So a girl who was dancing in the vineyards went and plucked him. And that was Saul's wife. It seems to be not the way we think, that they just went and they were rowdy cowboys, lassoed a girl and took him over his shoulder back home. It seems that the girls were in on the game, and we find later on in the Mishnah that this became the shidduch scene. Whoever couldn't get a shidduch in any normal way, the girls would go out dancing, and the guys would hide in the vineyards, and they'd see the girls dancing, and then they'd go and ask them out, and that was their speed dating, their version of getting a quick shidduch, and it worked. It worked. It was the way they got people married. People who couldn't find any other way. What? Tu Be'av, right? And that's what happens. And the tribe of Benjamin rebuilds their tribe. And each person in Israel goes back to his tribe and his family. And the Navi concludes the book of Shoftim with that pasuk, which we now understand has dual meaning. It says, in those days there was no king in Israel. Each person did what they saw was right. And here we understand, on the one hand, it's a word of the weakness of the Jewish people. On the other hand, it's a word of praise. Here the tribe of Benjamin numbers 600 people. Every other tribe had every reason in the world to say, I'm just going to take a little bit of Benjamin territory after what they did. They only have 600 people. Why shouldn't I take some of that? And they didn't do that. The pasuk stresses that the people of Israel had compassion over their brethren. After all that, we are still merciful people. And so the tribe of Benjamin divided among the 600 remaining men the rest of the territory that they had. And they rebuilt the territory of Benjamin. And Benjamin continued to be a tribe among Am Yisrael. This again shows us the self-restraint. There was no king there wagging his finger and saying, no one touch the Benjamin territory. And no one from Israel raised the finger to take a piece of Benjamin's land. Benjamin rebuilt their territory and rebuilt their tribe. And that brings us into the beginning of the book of Shmuel. One of the points that the Medrash says was the reason behind the times where we did have moral weakness throughout the period of the judges was the fact that the judges did not have a continuum. The judge died, and who would lead us? And even if you had the judge, some judges did not travel throughout Israel. The Medrash seems to say that all these people who died in this war, you had over here 66,000 people die. 40 people from Israel, 26,000 from Benjamin, 66,000 people. It's a big number. 66,000 people were killed by our self-inflicted wounds, by our civil war. And the Navi says that if the leaders of the time would have traveled to educate the people, then things wouldn't have looked this way. And that's why the book of Shmuel begins with the great prophet Elkanah, who does just that. He travels and travels and travels. He's always traveling, teaching Torah. Every year he traveled a different way, teaching Torah and bringing the people back to the Torah. His son Shmuel will go in his footsteps. And when Shmuel's own children will not travel, they will not go around teaching Torah, that's when the Jewish people will say, we've had it. We're not slipping back into the period of the judges. If your kids are not going in your footsteps, if they will not travel throughout the people of Israel, at this point we need a king. We need a central leading figure, and that's what we'll learn about Bezrat Hashem in the book of Shmuel.